We are just about 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. And as usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment, and remute yourself after that. And later on this evening, courtesy of Alan's hard work, we will have the contents of the deck in PDF format, the audio track, and the contents of the chat window will be up on our website. And welcome all. Welcome to any new people that we might have with us tonight. As always, everybody is welcome to join as a guest. And I am going to paste into the chat right now anybody who would like to join our happy little band. I pasted into the chat where you can go, or you can just come to our homepage, and in the top right, there will be a join and renew link, and you can just go through that. And it's $20 a year, the princely sum. And for anybody who's joining us from the States, that's in Canadian dollars, so even cheaper. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, we have a mixed bag tonight and a whole bunch of stuff from different people. So we're going to start off with a follow-up, and Chris is going to talk to VHS to digital.
Yeah, this was asked at the meeting on the 12th, and during that, David actually showed a box he had of a hardware product that actually can convert VHS to digital, and so you just plug it into the RCA jacks on your VHS player, and then plug the other end into your computer, and you can then convert them. And while it was during the meeting, Natalie looked up the product online and saw reviews indicating that it didn't work with Windows 10. And David checked on the box, and sure enough, it said it's designed for Windows 8. And so there were a lot of people who couldn't get it working in Windows 10. And so David later on, he emailed the suggestion box at opcug.ca mailbox, and he pointed out that Amazon has lots of them. And he pointed to one in specific one that was only $11 Canadian. And the URL is there on your screen and pasted into the chat as well. And there were a number of them that were there. I looked at a couple, and none of them talked about Windows 11, but a lot of them did say Windows 10. And it's highly likely that anything that works in Windows 10 would work in Windows 11 as well. So as another
also, you can tell Windows to simulate earlier parts of earlier Windows by one of the parameters for a particular program. You can say open this as though it were in Windows 8 or something like that. So
yeah,
there are alternatives.
Well, often with hardware devices, though, you're into driver issues, and so driver issues are a little bit harder to work around, but certainly something worth trying. But for $11. You can get a device that will work with at least Windows 10 and, as I say, probably Windows 11 as well.
That one also said Linux, Chris, as well. So.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very neat.
I have a comment. I had one of those older kits, and I hadn't used it. And I tried it, and I don't know. I think you have to have some software program to go with these things.
Yeah, highly likely, but you'd get that from the company. Yeah.
Yeah, so I looked at a lot of YouTube videos, and they suggested a couple of different software programs that convert from whatever this is to digital, but I don't know. I'm afraid
if you buy a hardware device like that, you should be able to download. Either it'll come with a CD or a DVD with the software you need, or you can connect to the manufacturer's website and download the required software.
Yeah, this one came with some kind of CD, but it talked about Windows 7.
Yeah.
And my new computer doesn't have a CD drive.
Oh, yeah, that can be a problem.
And I have one other question. I have a combination VHS-DVD. Now, does a DVD player read CDs?
It should.
Yes, it will.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I have photos that are on CDs.
Yep, should
and
be readable.
If I put it in my DVD drive.
You'll display them on your TV or whatever device you have hooked up to the... Yeah. Yeah, it should work.
But I can convert that also to digital?
Well, if it's CD, it's probably already digital media.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
all right.
So
not
a movie format.
The old pictures then.
Yeah.
You might be able to display them on your TV, maybe, but you wouldn't be able to send them to your PC ordinarily. Also,
but if I have the converter equipment,
then that should be able to read that would be that you can read a DVD with a movie on it and convert it to digital media on your computer.
Oh yeah, I don't want to do that. No, I have photos on CDs.
Yeah, you wouldn't use that conversion utility.
That wouldn't work. Okay.
Buy an external DVD player for your computer. And
yeah, I was thinking of that.
Yeah, then you have the CD and you just copy it onto your computer.
Pop it in. Yeah, you can get them for about $15 for
something
to plug into a USB port.
Okay.
So the other thing that was mentioned at the presentation was that the Ottawa Public Library actually has a digitization lab and with equipment that you can use on site to convert from VHS to digital, and then you can just pop it onto a flash drive or something like that at the digitization lab and take that home with you. But unfortunately, this is a quote from the OPL website, digitization lab at Beaverbrook Branch is currently unavailable until further notice. And then looking through their services, the Cumberland branch actually has a VHS station that is designed to be able to convert specifically to a DVD, so a VCR to a DVD. And then they have a note, apologies, this item is currently out of order. And then if you are looking at just generically of what equipment the Ottawa Public Library actually has for loan, I put the URL there. And that got pasted into the chat as well. They have a ton of different types of equipment that you can actually book out from the Ottawa Public Library. And that's it for that.
Well, Owen, thank you, Chris, because that's the same thing I was getting ready to say, because our public library has the same facilities.
Sorry?
I was going to say the same thing, because my public library has the same facilities.
Oh, okay. Okay, back to you, Alan.
Okay, another topic that we had previously was 3D printing, and Stu has looked up a whole bunch of resource material. So, Stu, tell us all about these things.
Well, I'm not doing any of this stuff myself, but remembering the chatter about 3D printing in the community here, I thought I'd share these websites that I came across recently, and there are several resources online to find stuff to print, and I don't know what they are for the most part. Probably lots of skulls and dragons and that sort of thing, but there might actually be something useful here too. So the first one is something called Printables, which has approximately 1.5 million files, all free. And the second one is Maker World, which is owned by some company called the Bamboo Lab. They make 3D printers, so they're interested in getting you to use their printers and have all these designs online. Could I have the next slide, please? I believe they're all free, too. And Thingiverse. Lots of thingies. Over 6 million thingies to print. It's supposed to be the oldest site on the web or the internet, whatever you prefer. And thanks. Not only do we have things, we have thanks. And it indexes stuff by shape rather than name. I can't really explain this. You're going to have to go just try it. It's free, though, so good luck. GrabCAD was the one that struck me as the most interesting for people that are trying to find actually useful things, because it was started by engineers as a place to store and share engineering CAD files. So it's a very technical site, and not terribly beginner-friendly, but not too difficult. I had a quick look at it, and I saw things like window brackets for various power windows in different cars, and well, 5 million files of trinkets that you actually need and use in some fashion or another. Worth checking out if you're trying to fix something. And just found this one yesterday. NASA. NASA has a website, or sorry, a link to all kinds of resources that you can print 3D models of their equipment and probes and spacecrafts, lunar terrain, landing sites. I didn't see any Klingons or Kardashians, but, you know, they might be there. And, yes, a little comment. There's been a bit of concern about printing material that we are wearing. Watch bands and fitness bands are a popular thing for people to print. But if we're doing fitness, we might just might sweat a little bit. And apparently the extended moist contact with our skins can release forever chemicals. A small amount. It's not a huge problem, but it might be worth checking out what material you're using to 3D print with if you're making something you tend to wear. The article was almost an advertisement for Google's non-carcinogenic watch band for their stuff, but you get the drift. Be careful out there.
Okay, thanks. So, thanks, Stu. And anybody who's watching the chat, Tom is suggesting that you should print the NASA stuff full size. I think I know what he means because they're normally models, but... Okay, next up, Chris has got an update on the Mail Store Home program.
Yeah, I've been playing around a lot with this. I'm actually quite a big fan of this software. It's been around a long time, but I just came across it quite recently, actually. And I did a presentation at Q&A back May 27th. And the idea behind Mail Store Home is that it allows you to archive mail from multiple email accounts that you have out there. And so a lot of us will have multiple email accounts, you know, various vendors that give them away or sell them. And you might have mail scattered across a whole bunch of places. And what do you do to back those up? You know, do you just count on the fact that they are going to be there forever, or do you want to preserve them somehow? Also, if you do use something like Mail Store Home, you can bring them down into a single archive where you can read them offline. You don't have to be connected to the internet. You can print them, search across all of your mail stores, and I find it quite handy for that. And one of the other benefits of it is to copy email from one mail server to another. Basically, what you do is you create the archive locally, and then you can export from there to another location, another mail server. So the first two work really, really well, and the third actually works fine, but there is a bit of a problem if you have lots of mail. And when you're exporting mail from a local archive, if the total number of emails in any selected folder or, and that includes its subfolders, exceeds somewhere around 2,000, then you're going to likely have problems. And the problem that you have is at some point you get a timeout error in the dialog box that talks about it exporting all your mail, and it never seems to recover from that timeout error. And if you restart it, you'll get to that same magic number of about 2,000 or whatever, and then you'll start getting those timeout errors again. So there's a couple of workarounds that I looked at, and one is to just export less than 2,000 emails at a time. So if you have something like you see on screen where I have an inbox, and what I did was I created temporary folders, inbox 1, inbox 2, inbox 3, and then I select batches of mail out of the inbox of less than 2,000 and move them, just drag and drop them, into the archive subfolder. And then you just keep going until you're finished on moving them all out of the inbox folder. So then you created an export job and select one of the folders as what you want to export to the remote server, making sure that that and all its subfolders would be less than 2,000 mails. Run the export job, and I've never had a problem when it had less than about 2,000 emails in a folder. It gets exported without any errors. Might take a while. Then you can go and you can export, edit the export job and select the next folder. In this case, I would select Inbox 2 and then run that export job. And then go in, edit the export job, select Inbox 3, and so forth. And you do that for all of the folders that you have where you have more than 2,000 emails in any particular folder. And then once they're all exported, if you want, you go to the destination server, and you will end up with, rather than having inbox, you'd have inbox 1, inbox 2, inbox 3, and you can consolidate them on that mail server if you want it, or you could just leave them in the separate folders the way they are there. A couple of other solutions. Well, one would be keep your mailbox at less than 2,000 emails. And you can see my reaction on that, and I imagine a lot of people's reaction trying to keep mailboxes where all folders are less than 2,000 emails might be a little bit of a challenge. Another thing you could do is don't bother exporting the email to a different mail server period. Just leave it in that local archive. So it still allows you to access all of the emails. You can read, print, search, and so forth. The only downsides really are that you can't reply to the emails. And then the archive does exist only on a single computer. But if you want, you could create archives on multiple computers. So if you do that, well, one of the things that I recommend is actually use the portable version of MailStore, and then there's nothing that is machine-specific on that installation. So what you can do is just take that entire folder that MailStore creates for you and copy it to another computer. It'll include the executable for MailStore Home, and you just run it on the other computer. So that's another way that you could actually do that. And that's it.
Okay, thanks, thanks, Chris. I think the answer is don't keep 18,000 emails. Does anybody read 17,999? Okay, next up we have a loony link from Tom. So, Tom, would you like to tell us about the privacy law?
Sure. He has this fellow that's the privacy lawyer. He's a lot older, actually, than his picture. He's got gray hair now and looks, you know, really substantial. So he keeps an eye on privacy legislation, and the most recent thing is, I think it's called Bill 22, where the government wants to give the government access to a whole variety of things without having to get a warrant. That's the big thing of it. But he looks into other aspects. It's not just federal, but also provincial. And he is talking about things that, basically, if you're concerned, then you should get involved and contact your MP or MPP about them with your particular opinion. It's very worthwhile, and he's very easy to listen to. And the YouTube things that he does are fairly short, usual 15 minutes or so. And he also has a blog that you may want to follow as well or instead of. And that's mentioned in his description on YouTube. So I recommend him if you're at all concerned about your privacy and whoever may look into it. It's surely not oriented towards protecting criminals. It's oriented to protecting you and what you're concerned with.
Okay, loony link from Tom. Thanks, Tom. Okay, we're always asking you questions. What can you do for us? And one of the things we ask is, do you have a favorite application for your computer or your smartphone, and Windows, Android, or Linux? And Stu sent us this one, which is called the Sponge. Stu?
How many of you have too many doggone photos that you just haven't got around to cleaning up yet? Well, if that's you, I have another question. Have you ever used one of those dating apps? You know, you swipe right, swipe left, blah, blah, blah. Well, the sponge may be what you need to have fun with cleaning up your photos. The free version will let you sort it by date, like by each month or what have you. And you just go through your pictures really quickly, and if you want to get rid of it, you swipe left. If you want to keep it, you swipe right, or whatever, you just keep going. And then you can have a nice little pile of photos that you'd like to have dinner with. If you can't get through it all in one setting, Sponge will remember where you left off and let you pick up when you get back to it. It's available for iOS and Android. The paid versions are, what did I write? $6.99 for 3 months or $14.99 lifetime fees. I assume that's U.S. And as Tom likes to point out, lifetime is either your lifetime or the life of the company, whichever comes first. Okay. But it's a little gamification to cleaning up your photos. Have some fun with it.
Right, thanks,
Stu. Okie doke.
Okay, next up, I have a utility program for renaming files. I like the ability to be able to batch rename files, and this program is called Invisco Rename. It's an open source program released under the GPL, Polish programmer. And he hasn't changed it since June of 2022. And in fact, the site is now archived. So I think that means he thinks it is fully debugged and nobody has to do anything with it again. Now you can download it from GitHub and it comes as a 7-zip archive file. And I believe that you get, when I downloaded it, I got an .exe file, which I just ran. I didn't have to install it. And it's really straightforward. It gives you kind of batch renaming capabilities. So when you load it, you get this this view. And it basically shows you in the left-hand pane here, it says current name. It shows you the disks on your computer that are available. So you can navigate down to, let's say, the D drive, and then down to a folder which I've called test. And I've got all these image files, JPEG files, which have come from a camera or a phone, and they have these inscrutable file names with 10 million numbers, which mean absolutely nothing, at least they mean absolutely nothing to me. So if I have image files with these kind of names, personally I like to rename them in a batch to something that is more meaningful. So what you can do is you can go down to this name tab down here, and you've got various options to tell the program what kind of name you would like. And probably the easiest one, and because this is just all garbage numbers, just replace the whole name with something that makes sense. So it can be anything you want. So I've chosen here just to call it a base file name. But you notice that I've put a hyphen on the end, so it's base file name, and then clearly there's going to be something else. And you also see that in the preview, it tells me that all the files are going to have the same name. Clearly that's not a good idea. So we do need to do something else. And the thing we need to do is go to this tab here, which says numbering. By default, it would be no numbering. But what I want to do, because of that hanging hyphen, I want to add a number after the base file name. So I select the radio button here for after the file name. I tell it to start at number 1, increment it by 1, so the numbers will be 1, 2, 3, etc. But I'm also going to add some fill, zero fill. So I'm going to add 2 zeros, so my numbers are actually going to be 001, 002. And you can see here that that's exactly what I've got in the preview. base file name 1, base file name 2, etc. So that preview looks good. So now I can move on and I can just hit this rename button here. And it says, am I sure? Do I want to proceed? Yes, I want to proceed. And lo and behold, all the current names are now the renamed options that we have just described. And if we go to the file, the actual file folder, you'll see that my test folder no longer has weird number file names, but it has easy to understand name plus a numerical sequence. And clearly you can tailor that file name format in many different ways as you wish. Very easy program to use, free and open source, and I highly recommend it if you just want to do batch file renaming. Does Invisca have an undo button? Not sure.
If you go back a couple of slides, there is an undo.
Well, okay. Right. I believe it. I'm not going back. Try it out. It's free, and just try it. If it works, keep it. If it doesn't work, throw it away and find something better. And then come and give us a review of your choice. There you go. Can't say better than that. Okay, next up, Chris has got a share on, of all things, AI.
Yeah, this is Kim crossed this idea. I'd come across it before, but it came to the front a little bit more just recently. And it was the whole idea that a lot of the AI-generated material out there is what they call AI slop. So low effort, mass-produced, generic, repetitive, nonsensical, so forth. So can you actually avoid having AI generate AI slop? And, well, maybe you can. So this was something I came across on Twitter, and this person suggested that you put in a simple prompt that can eliminate most signs that it was generated by AI. And this is specifically talking about text. And upload it before every conversation, or if you have some of the large language models or AI models out there, have the ability to add a customization instruction set that gets given to every time you use it. And perplexity.ai is one of them. And if you just go to your profile picture in the bottom left, go to all settings, personalization, custom instructions, and then you can just paste in perhaps the suggested one. I thought this was funny. Some of it I actually had to look up some of these terms. I didn't know what they actually meant. But, no rhetorical crutches, no negative parallelisms, no M-dashes. That was interesting. I'm not sure why you would be against M-dashes. No setup payoff constructions, very sentence length unpredictably, and so forth. So this person suggested that if you actually put all of this stuff in here, then you will end up with stuff that looks a little bit less like it was generated by AI. And other people, of course, chimed in, as people on Twitter want to do so, and some of them suggested some additional things. So if you know a good writer, that you like the way that they write, and they have a large body of work, and you could say your response should be in the style of and that particular author. Maybe, maybe not. Who knows? This was an interesting one, too, I thought. Adhere to ADS-SDE100 Simplified Technical English. And this is some kind of standard that is out there that is meant to ensure that writing is clear, consistent, easily translated, and so forth. So a couple of people actually recommended that. Somebody said, and none of that AI writing nonsense. Okay. Somebody suggested avoid all AI tells, which I'm not sure how any AI would actually interpret that. Write it in the human voice. And then there's some other ideas that I thought were a little bit more in tongue-in-cheek. First, what somebody just said, you can just write it yourself. or somebody suggested, write like Genghis Khan. I don't know what that would generate. I guess, I don't know. And somebody said, no words, no letters, no punctuation, no Altman. Sam Altman is the head of OpenAI. No nothing, just don't. I thought that was a quite clever response to all of this. And then, so having had a little bit of fun with that, then I thought about the idea, can you actually tell if something was actually generated by AI or not? And I came across this interesting site called Pangram. And they claim that they have customers that are in universities and corporations and things like that that are specifically looking for material that was generated by AI. And a lot of the educational institutions, of course, are interested in making sure that students aren't just turning in material that was totally generated by AI. And so they said they can detect it with an accuracy of 99.98. I'm not sure why they didn't go to five nines, but there you go. You can get a free account there, which will allow you to check 2,000 words per day, or they have a new version, a new facility on there, which is detecting whether images were generated by AI, and you can do 3 images per day. And now they don't give you any advice on how you can make your output look less like AI, like the previous slides were talking about, but I thought it was interesting, this idea of being able to detect whether it was generated by AI or not. So I had this example, and this came from my presentation on AI, and I asked Microsoft Copilot to create a storyline for a children's bedtime story about a handsome prince who saves a fair maiden who has been held by an evil dragon. Both are strong, very strong characters. They work together to get free. That's all I said it. And then it came up with a storyline, and then I told it, okay, generate a whole story from that. And when I uploaded the output for that story, which was only, 400 words or something like that, 445 words, was a fairly short story, but it came back and said 100% certainty that this was generated by AI. I thought, oh, that's interesting. I thought it was actually a pretty good story that it generated, but it came to the conclusion that it was AI generated. So then I started looking at it from an image point of view, and I'm a photographer, and so I uploaded this true image that I had. This was something I took when I was out west. I removed the EXIF information from the image just on the idea that perhaps it would give some kind of indication that it was AI generated if there was no EXIF information in there. But I uploaded and it came up saying that pure and simple, it was right over to the left, no AI. So I thought that that was not generated by AI. So then I took that photograph and I actually uploaded it to Gemini and I just said remove the fence. Now, Gemini did an awful lot more. If you look at the tree in particular, you can see that the tree is completely different. Its angle onto the totem is a little bit different. So I think it just replaced the image with something that was just totally somebody else's image. So interestingly, it thought that it was fully AI generated. And so to me, just looking at it with my eyeballs, I couldn't see any tells on there that said this was AI generated, but they came to the conclusion, 100% guaranteed, that it was AI generated. Okay, that's interesting. What if I do editing on photos? So here I have a photograph that I took down near Belleville, and that's the original image. And I brought it into my photo editor, Almond Photo Raw 2026. I cloned out the vents that you see on the top of the barn on the left-hand side. And then I had that big green blob near the bottom right, and I just did a content-aware eraser on that. And I fed that image up to Pangram, and it said no AI. I thought, that's pretty interesting that I can do pretty extensive editing, including content-aware erasers on it, and it did not think that that was AI-generated. So to take another step, I took my original image, and I edited it in Gemini. So I uploaded it to Gemini, and I told it, remove the vents on top of the barn and remove the large, darker green bush near the center. And then I took a screenshot of the output just so that there was no metadata in the image, no way that it could tell that there was stuff that the Gemini had actually embedded in the image that would be an indication that it was actually generated by AI. And Pangram came back and said, fully AI. Now, I haven't had any tests where it came back with anything less than 100% certain that it was not AI or 100% certain that it was AI. So I thought this was kind of an interesting site. And so if you want to check whether you think something was generated by AI or not, maybe try it out. If you come up with something where it got it wrong, it might be nice to do an update at some point, a Q&A, and show the images or the writing that Pangram got wrong. But so far, it's been 100% correct.
If you look at that dark-colored bush, it has a different position. All it did was clone it further down.
Yeah, it just moved it. But still, it's a matter of that, like, if I could have done that with On One Photo Raw, I could have done content aware erasure and just said move it over to somewhere else in the image. I suspect it would have done exactly the same, where it would come back and say, no, it wasn't AI. If it can do a content aware erasure, then moving it shouldn't be anything different from that. So I just thought it was interesting that it could actually pick up the Gemini image saying that, yeah, it was AI generated.
Did it say to look that way?
No, they have you can see just above the image that Pangram has, there's original and heat map. And the heat map, I presume, will show you the areas that it thought was generated by AI or were tells of it. But the heat map always just shows the entire image red. So it doesn't seem to hone in on specific sections that it thinks were generated by AI.
If you look at the two totem pictures, the second picture is actually taken from a spot further left of the original picture.
Yeah, that's what I said. That's what I said was the angle on the totem was actually wrong. And down at the base of it as well, the base was actually different. And I don't know what it was, but it was obviously an older photo that they was working with from Gemini. Because I just took this, this recently. Different angle and different height it was taken at as well. The mountains in the background are different angle on them and so forth. So I think they just replaced the image totally. But I took a screenshot of it and just so that there was, again, nothing that Gemini was adding to the image that would be an indicator that in metadata that it was AI generated. And so it couldn't have those tells, yet they came back, told me it was AI.
So AI cheats. It was probably easier and cheaper just take an old image rather than actually make the changes that you requested.
Yeah. In this case, it was. Most of the times where I've told Gemini or any of the AI models out there to do edits, it didn't do this where it just did a wholesale replacement of the entire photograph. It actually did go through and make individual edits, as you saw on this one here, where it actually did, the tree on the left, it looks like it didn't touch anything there, but it did remove the vents on the barn, and rather than removing the green bush, it moved it over to the side. So, but the other stuff in the image, it doesn't look like it did anything to replace all the rest of it. So I don't know why it did on the totem.
If you go back to the totem pole, did you know, are those two different pictures of the totem pole? Because
yeah, they are. That's what I'm saying, is they just replaced it with something totally different.
No, I mean the totem pole itself. In the second image, you're seeing it more from the side.
Yeah, that's what we've been saying. It's a different angle on that totem. It was a different photograph of the totem.
So it
was taken at that location, I'm sure.
Oh, okay. So they just put a whole new photograph of the totem because...
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it's a different angle of the totem pole. You see more of the eye and blah, blah, blah.
Yep. But it looks...
A rubbish edit, Chris, because you told it to remove the fence and the fence is still there.
And the sign on the fence and the weeds look...
No, actually, that's not a fence. That's a wall. That's a stone wall.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. I see what you mean.
Yeah.
I think there's a movement, maybe they've already adopted it, but that AI programs, when they create something, they will actually have some kind of bit in the picture or some field in the picture that says that it's AI generated. And I guess you're editing program doesn't do that, but obviously, but Google or Gemini does. That's my
guess. I don't know. I know that they're looking at ways of embedding it in metadata, and that's why I took a screenshot of it, so that if it was embedding data into metadata, then it wouldn't be able to tell, because I just took a screenshot of it. Whether they are actually saying, you know, the third pixel in and the, you know, 4 pixels down, it should be this particular color. If it's, you know, 1 pixel, a different color, if it tells that it's AI, I don't know. Potentially they could be doing something like that, but I haven't heard of anything that is saying that it will actually do that. So I don't know. I was curious.
Okay, well, it'll be interesting to see if somebody else does some examples where it works and it doesn't.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so I've another utility here, but I'm not calling this a favorite because I've actually only used it today. I actually saw this article in PC World, the website, an application lets you grab text from anywhere on the screen, including text in an image. And it's called NormCap. And it's, again, an open source product. So if you go to, I believe it's GitHub, then you'll find that there are versions available for Windows and Linux and macOS. And I downloaded the Windows version. And so it's open source. It's cross-platform, Windows, Linux, and macOS. It supports multiple monitors if you're running more than one monitor. It will interpret QR and barcodes. It will deal with multiple languages, it says. I haven't tried that. And it has rule-based parsing, which I imagine you can play with, but I don't really know. And they say it's privacy first, which I think just means that they don't send anything back to home base. But it's kind of interesting. For example, this is a shot from the Ottawa Public Library, and I'm searching here for ebooks, and I'm searching for ebooks in the technology area. And I found this one here. There's a cover shot here of this Python data training cookbook, and I don't want to borrow it right now, but I would like to actually grab the information about it. So I can fire up this this little utility program, point it at the book cover image here, and it basically lets you draw a little red line around the image that you want to grab the text from. And once you do that, then you can copy it to the clipboard and then fire it into a text editor. Now you notice here that it isn't 100% perfect. It has problems when the text isn't very clear, if it's tiny, if there's a low contrast. So, for example, Expert SGHT doesn't look correct. Everything else, I think, is. It gets to the author, and Packet, I think, is the publisher. But if you look at the cover, you'll find that it actually missed a section. So what it really should have said was Expert Insight, but you have to blow the thing up so you can read that properly. And it got this red, kind of pale red text on the black background, which isn't tremendously contrast worthy, but it got that all right. There's the publisher or whatever it is. But you see it missed this term here, second edition. But generally it did a fairly good job. Another example I have, right, that's just showing you the things it missed here. Another example I have here is a program called Taxman. This is a Canadian product. Gordon Thompson is an accountant who specializes in tax returns. He lives in Victoria on the West Coast. And he provides this, he uses this program for his clients, but he provides the runtime version. It's basically an Access database. He provides the runtime version free and updates it every year so you can do your taxes. It's completely offline. The only downside is that you can't e-file. You have to print paper forms and mail them in, or transcribe the information and all the calculations, the numbers and stuff, onto some other medium. Printing the forms and mailing them is cheaper than buying the other people's software. Anyway, the point is that when you load the software, he pops up this help menu here. The tax man must know, so you need to know all this stuff. The problem is that only appears on this one screen, and I can't cut and paste. I can't grab this text off the screen normally and drop it into a text file. But if I use the magic program, it it draws a red line around, captures it, I drop it into my notepad, and it's basically got everything word for word. There's a couple of artifacts here. I noticed that there's an apostrophe which starts off the sentences here, which doesn't exist in the original. But otherwise, the text is word perfect, as they say. So, I've actually been using this today. I've been doing some vibe coding, developing a VBA macro for Excel, and I kept getting errors, and the errors pop up in an image box, essentially. Again, you can't cut and paste the errors, and that's unfortunate when you're vibe coding, because you want to just cut the error and paste it back into the chatbot and let it figure out what's wrong. Well, using this little utility program, I can do exactly that. The error pops up, I draw the box, I grab the text, I give it to the chatbot, and it generates some new code for me. So it's a really handy little utility if you need to be able to grab text from an image where you can't do that previously. Okay.
Go back one slide, Alan. A caution of if it's important that it's correct, make sure it's correct. I just happened to notice in the line above the second red circle, or two lines above, it says there's not much more. And I look back on the original, and it's not much more or much there. So it is good to proof anything that does OCRing, no matter what the program is doing OCRing, make sure you validate the information, if it's important that it's correct.
Unfortunately, I think that one will be caught by a spell checker, right?
In that case, yeah.
Yeah,
that's what I thought. It was maybe it was Natch or something like that, but it was not.
If you do get any errors, if you get an error box in a program or something, often you can click on the error box, go Control C, and it copies the contents of the box, and you can use that directly later.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Didn't know that. I'll have to try that. Thanks, Tom.
Natalie says, "What are the norm cap options for file formats?" I presume it just puts out plain text, right?
I believe, yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Okay, so then you can paste it in wherever you need it. Okay.
What's that vertical line that it has after that much there? That's supposed
Isn't
to be
it?
An
I. I wrote it. I wrote it just for you. I.
Except that's not an I.
Well, I think it is.
No, actually, because the capital
you look
I.
Down
has,
to a capital I.
Yeah,
they
have Cerise.
That's right.
I can't find it.
If. 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth line up from the bottom. Capital I and if.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Point taken.
So, again, double check if it's important.
So it's not word perfect, but it's pretty close.
There you go.
Okay. Word perfect is obsolete.
No, it's not. Still sold. Okay, I've got an update. This goes way, way back to June of 2025. I actually had a share I had on how you could get a space selfie taken. And so Mark Rober, who does a lot of humorous YouTube videos, he actually spent money, $5 million, to get a satellite set up that it could actually take a picture with the Earth in the background, and it would have a small LCD screen that he could upload an image to, and so you could get a selfie of you from space. And so the website where you can actually get that done is there. And then I sort of forgot about it after a couple of months. And they did say that there was a big backlog and you could expect to wait up to a year or so. And so the just seeing who's making noise here. I'm going to mute anybody who may be making noise. Okay, so just 2 days ago, I got an email from Crunch Labs saying that my space selfie was ready to view. And it gives me a link where I can actually go and I can see my space selfie. And this is what it gave me. Not a terribly interesting background. It got a lot of cloud. I don't know exactly where it is over. I think that when I asked for it, I asked for it to be taken over top of my geographic location. But I can't remember for sure that I did that. And I certainly can't tell from the image that it was taken over Ottawa.
I see your house down there, Chris.
Yeah, right.
It looks like Mars.
It is a fairly high-resolution image, 12-megapixel image, 4,000 by 3,159 pixels, so it's got good resolution to it, which I thought was kind of neat. So if you want to have your own space selfie done, you know, I paste it into the chat where you can go. You can sign up for it. You can probably end up waiting a year or more. If you want it faster, you can actually
do it in Photoshop in a few minutes, yeah.
No. And you can actually go and pay for a service that they're actually selling through Crunch Labs. You'll actually get a product or something like that. But if you actually do buy a product from them, apparently you jump the queue and you'll get it a lot faster. I was not interested in any of their products, so I just waited in the slow queue. And as you see, it took a little bit over a year for it to actually take the picture. So the process is that you take a selfie, or I guess any picture you want, and then they send it to the satellite, they put it on the screen, and then they take a picture of the screen with the Earth in the background. So if you want your own space selfie, you can get it for free if you go to that site. That's it.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Okay, so we've been trying to leave enough time for the last 10 in the last few weeks. We've made it to the last 7, I guess, today. So if people have other questions or shares or comments or anything you want to talk about, now is the time. You're allowed to put up your hand by using the
raise hand.
Raise hand thing somewhere down there.
Yeah.
Or put something in the chat or just open your microphone and everybody can talk at once.
Nothing so far.
Well, nobody can. Nobody wants to do anything. I've got some slides.
Hello. Just thought I'd mention, I don't know if anybody knows, but the passport renewals for Canadians can now be done online so that you don't have to go stand at Meadowland for hours on end to give your form. You get a digital picture from wherever you're getting your passport pictures. I went to Suitors at Billings Bridge. They emailed it to me. And you go through Service Canada. They've changed their portal, so you've got to either use an authenticator app or something like that. I ended up going through using an email, and they sent me recovery codes, and all of that was a kind of long process, but once you create the new account to be able to do this, it really went quickly. The first picture I got from Suitors, the person was not used to taking passport pictures because I had kind of like a white blouse on top of my sweater, So a white blouse with a white background is not acceptable in any way, shape, or form. So I went back and said it was rejected. They took a new picture where I didn't have a white blouse. And you go through, you know, you put in your name, your address, all your information. The same thing as filling out a real passport form, you upload the picture as a JPEG file. And for your references, you just type in their name, their phone number, how long you've known them, stuff like that. You go through this whole thing, and bing, 10, 15 minutes, it's done. It's that easy. And I did not have to go to Service Canada to stand in line. And now they've sent me a confirmation saying I will get a new passport within, they say, 20 working days. We will see. And my current passport, I don't have to give it anywhere. I don't have to do anything. They want me to cut something off because they say it's no longer valid. But anyways, I thought it was right cool. You know, so I did do this, and it went really, really well once I had all the information. At first, I didn't have the reference information. I was calling my friend getting information, and it threw me out. So I thought, okay, get everything and then work your way through it. So that's all.
Yeah, it's just a little bit more information on that. I just recently was helping somebody else with this idea, and I looked up some of the information. You have to have your current passport can't be expired. It has to be valid for 5 or 10 years, which is the norm, so I don't know why they even say that. Issued in the last 15 years. Shows your place of birth, which my understanding is they always show your place of birth, but anyway. And what was it? If it expires in more than six months, you can't renew it online. So you have to wait until it is within 6 months of expiry before you can actually do this online renewal.
But I think that you can't do a paper renewal either within.
Oh, okay.
So I think that that's about normal. And I mean, like my passport was supposed to expire in January, so I was within the 6 months.
Yeah.
And I think you have to be accessing it from within Canada. Like,
yeah. Your home and mailing address also have to be in Canada as well. They won't mail it out of Canada.
Yeah, but, you know, it supposedly has been on pilot for a little while because I talked about it today with a group I was at. And one of the ladies had been on the pilot project for it, and there were some different steps in there. But it is now anybody who's in that criteria.
Yeah, and they also say you can't have had it reported lost or stolen, your current one, seized or surrendered, and you're not declaring it found after such a report. So good to check out the requirements online, but yeah, really nice not to have to go line up. Thanks, Russ.
So Elizabeth has a note here that the next time she gets a rebate, like the bread fixing settlement, which was Loblaws and AFL, and they ask if I want direct deposit or a check. I think a check is probably the best option because the scammers have had 2 years to figure out how to do the online thing. Not sure they always give you the option for a check, that's the problem. Okay, anything else? 29.
I'm seeing Natalie's comment about CAA plus membership, and I had totally forgotten about that, and I went to pay for a picture. But anyways, too late. I should have been 10 years. Good thing to know.
Yeah, it is one of the nice perks of CAA membership. And I think it's cheaper. If you can still get it if you're just a regular CAA membership, but it costs you something. But I think it's still cheaper than any other passport photo place.
Okay, well, we've hit 8:30, and there's not a ton of things in the chat window, I don't think.
Nope.
So let me just do the wrap-up. And we're always asking you to help out, and here's another one. And we're basically looking for shares. So if you have any information you want to give us about your particular favorite application, hardware or accessories that you've bought, used, found useful, operating system information, Windows, Linux, Android, I guess Mac, those of you who are on the dark side. Chris is always interested in internet safety and security stuff.
Oh, for sure.
I'm sure Chris and Linda would love to know your comments about digital photography and anything you have in terms of tips and techniques and that kind of stuff. So you don't have to be a professional speaker. Chris and I can attest to that. but if you want to share anything, just give us a little email and we'll be happy to try and help out. But by the same token, if you need help from somebody else, and especially if your question doesn't fit into either the members forum where you can get instant access 24/7 or a Q&A question, if you have something that needs a bit more hands-on or remote hands-on, I guess, for members of the club, we have this one-on-one remote assistance program. So if you have something that you can't be really handled by an online or a Zoom session in the Q&A format, but you need somebody, a volunteer to help, you can check out the one-on-one remote assistance program. Now, you basically ask for help. You know, we circulate it to the people who volunteer to help. If somebody thinks they can assist you, then they'll get in touch and try and fix your problem. And I think so far we've been pretty successful. We had one instance only that I remember that nobody could figure out a solution, but everything else I think we've dealt with reasonably well.
Yep.
Okay. Last few times I've been asking people to consider writing an article for the newsletter. Bridget is always looking for computer-related articles. And if you check the, that's her email address right there, if you want to send something, you've missed the deadline for the September issue because Bridget released that today, actually. And included in the September newsletter, you'll find on one of the pages, you'll find this call for articles. And she says that the stack of available articles is thin, and she's looking for articles written by members. And we do have articles from the APCUG, but even though they're limited, so they don't last forever necessarily. And so basically anything computer related, send it to Bridget, and she will be happy to publish your original work. Okay, next up, Chris has a share on a get-together.
Why me? So this was just decided.
To Harvey. Harvey has a share on a get-together.
Yeah, Harvey's on the call.
One second, I'm turning on my mic. Yeah, so anyways, I was thinking about this Olive Garden. It's quite a good place to go. And this is one that has now started up in Ottawa, if you know where Hampton Park is. And I thought maybe that's a good place for us to get together. We're trying to look forward to, let's say, I think it was October 21st.
Yep.
And hopefully we'll get a good turnout. I think the last time was at the Big Rig. I'm not sure if we had 20 or 25 people, but it's a good get-together for everybody. So come on out and let's see it. But anyway, send an email so that we can tell whether you're coming. It's the Olive Garden at opcug.ca. Let us know if you're coming.
Okay, thanks very much, Harvey.
All righty.
Okay, so the final thing I have is a note. As usual, next Wednesday is up to August 26th. That will be our next Q&A session. So if you have questions, we have one question already in the chat, I see, but we'll deal with that next time. If you have follow-up on things we've talked about tonight or topics, programs that you'd like to share with the group, just send us some information to suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we will add you to next week's agenda. Hope everybody enjoyed tonight, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks, and thanks for all the contributors. We'll see you next week.